Very good morning to you. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press briefing today, the 10th of March. As you will have seen, we have a very, very busy agenda for you today. We have the situation in South Sudan, in Lebanon, in the Middle East, the wider region, as well as in Afghanistan. And we have some important announcements as well towards the end of this briefing. So we'll get to it straight away. We have a shift in the order, if you allow us. We're going to turn to South Sudan first. We have our colleague from the UN Human Rights Office, Saif Magengango, who's joining us from Nairobi, who will speak to the current situation in South Sudan. So over to you, Saif.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, everyone. Nice to be here. We are horrified by the growing accounts of serious violations in the ongoing conflict in South Sudan, including gruesome killings, the destruction of, and poisoning of key water sources, and fresh waves of mass displacement. Over the past 17 days, more than 160 civilians have been killed, at least 139 by fighters from the Bul Nuer ethnic group in Abiyanon locality in the Ruweng administrative area on the 1st of March. On 21 February, 21 civilians were killed by government forces in Pankor village, Ayod County in Jonglei state. The soldiers lured them into gathering at one place, promising to give them food aid, then opened fire on them. 15 women and 3 girls were among those killed. That same day, soldiers reportedly tied up and beheaded 4 civilians, one elderly man, a woman, a boy, and a girl, in Tiam village in Wau Payam, Western Bahr el-Ghazal state. The South Sudanese armed forces have reportedly destroyed or intentionally poisoned approximately 99 wells during government airstrikes. Some of these acts may amount to war crimes. There must be prompt, impartial, thorough, and effective investigations into these and all other allegations of violations of the laws of war and of international human rights law, which are taking place. And those found responsible must be fully, held to account, including those bearing superior and command responsibility. On 6 March, the military issued an evacuation order for all civilians in Akobo town and surrounding villages in the east. It also directed the closure and withdrawal of the UN mission in South Sudan's temporary operating base in Akobo, as well as the withdrawal of all other humanitarian agencies and NGOs. We call for a ceasefire to be agreed as promptly as possible to save lives and to turn this conflict in the direction of a negotiated solution. Parties to the conflict must also desist from attacking civilians and civilian objects and ensure safe and sustained flow of humanitarian aid to all in need, consistent with their obligations under international law. Both parties must also take prompt and meaningful steps with the support of the international community to rescue the fledgling peace process. South Sudan must be pulled back from the brink of all-out civil conflict.
Thank you very much, Saif.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take questions. Emma of Reuters has a question.
Good morning. I'd like to know more about the poisoning of the water supplies. What are they poisoning the water with? And how bad is the thirst in the area? Is anyone actually at risk of dying of thirst as a result? And secondly, just if you could clarify whether you've verified yourself using your own methodology the death toll of 160, and specifically also the beheadings, whether you've verified those reports yourself. Thank you.
Yes, thanks for that question. The poisoning of the wells is being done. What has happened is that they've gone and bombed these boreholes and water wells. And in some cases, civilians told our team on the ground that they have physically broken these boreholes and poured unknown substances into them. We don't know what the substances are. It is indeed, as you know, South Sudan has been beset by conflict for a long time. There's always been problems with access to food, water, sanitation, and definitely this destruction of water wells will lead to more thirst and hunger. With regard to the figures, yes, we have documented these figures. Our colleagues on the ground have been in touch with people affected in these areas, and they can confirm that these killings indeed took place. The number that we have published is the number of civilians. You'll have seen other numbers earlier on that are higher, but those ones may include other people who are not civilians. We strictly looked at civilian casualties in this instance.
Sorry, thank you, Saif. For the questions in the room, online, no, I don't see that's the case. Let me just suggest, colleagues, that you read the note that our humanitarian colleagues from OCHA sent last night, which has a section on South Sudan through which our colleagues express, or rather warn, that these military actions, which you just heard about in Jonglei State, which is near the border of Ethiopia, inside South Sudan, how this can put civilians at grave risk and can trigger a catastrophic humanitarian crisis. So this is a note that you maybe want to use to complement your reporting. Saif, thank you very, very much for joining us. And please do keep us informed on the dire situation in the country. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on, colleagues, we're going to connect with our colleague from the Refugee Agency. Babar is with us, as always, to answer any questions you may have for him. Carolina Lindholm-Billing is UNHCR's representative in Lebanon, joining us again from Beirut, who will speak to the humanitarian displacement situation inside the country. We also have, immediately afterwards, a colleague from the World Health Organization, the representative for the World Health Organization, also in Lebanon, Dr. Abu Bakar, will be joining us. So we'll take first you, Carolina, and then Abid Nizar. So over to Carolina. You're muted. We can't hear you, so let's just make sure that we have audio. Are you unmuted on your side?
There. Can you hear me now?
Now we can. Perfect. Go ahead,
good.
Please.
Sorry about that. Yeah. No, as you know, it's been just over a week since the new escalation in conflict started on the 2nd of March, when these Israeli evacuation warnings to residents of more than 53 villages and densely populated areas in Lebanon and the intensified airstrikes forced families across Lebanon to flee. And what we see here is that lives have been upended on a massive scale. I mean, according to the Lebanese authorities, as of today, more than 667,000 people in Lebanon have now registered on the government's online platform as displaced. And this is an increase of 100,000 in just one day. And the numbers continue to rise as we speak. And around 120,000 of those displaced are sheltering in government-designated collective sites, but many others are staying with relatives or friends or still searching for accommodation. And we see cars lined along the street with people sleeping in them and also on the sidewalks. And many of the displaced are now displaced for the second time since the hostilities in 2024. And most fled in a rush with almost nothing. And they're seeking safety in Beirut, Mount Lebanon region, in northern Lebanon and parts of the Bekaa. And just to illustrate, I mean, during a visit yesterday that I did to a shelter in Beirut, I met with a woman in her 90s who had said she had lost 11 members of her family back in 2024 during the intensification then, and she's now displaced again, staying in the same school that was turned into a shelter in 2024 and now again in 2026. And stories like hers really illustrate the fear, uncertainty, and repeated trauma that these hundreds of thousands of people are facing right now. And we're also seeing an increase of movements into Syria. According to the Syrian authorities, more than 78,000 Syrians have entered from Lebanon since the escalation began, plus over 7,700 Lebanese. And among the Syrians are Syrian refugees who had been planning to return in the coming months, but also others who are now rushing to return due to the escalation and fear. UNHCR's teams are present on the Syrian border crossing alongside the authorities and partners to support those arriving with essential relief. And in Lebanon, since the first day, 2nd of March, UNHCR has supported the government and its local authorities in responding to this crisis. And to date, as UNHCR, we have delivered around 168,000 emergency items to more than 63,000 displaced people across 270 of the government-designated collective shelters. And this includes mattresses, blankets, sleeping mats, solar lamps, and so on to help displaced families meet their most urgent needs. But to ensure this critical assistance reaches as many displaced people as quickly as possible, we're dispatching relief items from our warehouse to these collective shelters through multiple channels in partnership with NGOs, as well as through the municipal authorities and partners like the Lebanese Red Cross. But I've seen also very much firsthand this week how the volatile situation and this displacement is triggering emotional trauma. Children and adults alike, including many older now displaced people, are really in shock and in fear. And UNHCR, through community centers, outreach volunteers, and protection partners, are scaling up psychosocial support, identifying people at heightened risk, and helping to reunify separated children with families, and also prioritizing people with low mobility and disabilities who are struggling particularly in this rapid displacement crisis. But at the current pace of displacement, we're working very hard to replenish our country-level stocks of essential items. But UNHCR's operation in Lebanon is currently only 14% funded. And this, therefore, the fast and sustained international solidarity is really critical to enable us to support the Lebanese government and its authorities in responding to the emerging needs. And every day as this conflict continues, more suffering is inflicted on hundreds of thousands of civilians, while Lebanon and the region are further destabilized. And just to end by recalling that civilians must be protected at all times and that safe, unhindered humanitarian access must be guaranteed so aid can reach those most in need. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Carolina. Absolutely important messages there. And thanks for the update. And Babar has shared the notes with all the figures, so thank you again. We're going to go immediately to Dr. Aboubakar, WHO's representative, also joining us from Beirut. Over to you, Doctor. Okay, we're just...
Yes, good morning, colleagues, and thanks for inviting us to share our, situation here in Lebanon. As my colleague have said, actually, the Lebanon is facing a severe humanitarian and public health consequences of the conflict, with health system, with health system already weakened by years of economic crisis, workforce losses, and also previous conflict. The expansion of the evacuation orders has triggered large-scale displacement and increased pressure on already fragile services and communities. Overcrowding of the shelters, but also host communities and homes, is heightening the public health risk, including disease outbreaks, interruption to the routine health services, but also disruption of care of chronic diseases, maternal health care, mental health, among others. Hospitals and frontline responders are under extraordinary strain, managing rising number of injured patients while trying to maintain the essential services. The latest figures that we have, you know, is as of the 9th of March. So far, there are 486 people that have been killed. There's a 1,313 injured. Among those injured and also killed, 20% of the casualty are children, which is significant as compared to the previous conflict. We also have a 20% of those, you know, wounded casualty are women. But also this time we have an increased number of refugees and migrant workers that account for 10% of all casualties. This heightens their vulnerability when it comes to this conflict. Attacks and healthcare actually have resulted in the deaths of 19 healthcare workers and injuries, 26 paramedics, as well as other healthcare workers. In total, we have also 56 health facilities that have been impacted, including 5 hospitals, which are now out of service, 4 partially damaged, but also almost 43 primary healthcare centers, which is closed mostly in the south, in the area that's been evacuated. So far, I think WHO has been working with the Minister of Health, but also health sector partners in supporting of increasing the access to hospital care, including facilities coverage for war wounded Syrian refugees and migrant populations, while the Minister of Health is continuing to ensure that the coverage of Lebanese nationality. We are also, WHO is supporting frontline hospitals to strengthen their mass casualty management capacity, and they can also respond to the increasing numbers of injured patients while maintaining critical services. WHO also is reinforcing disease surveillance and early warning surveillance, including deploying surveillance staff to shelters and expanding call centers capacity for early detection, rapid response to potential outbreaks. As my colleague have earlier shared, that some of those shelters are overcrowded and there's poor water and sanitation. And that actually is the ingredients of potential disease outbreaks. And we are working with the Minister of Health to detect it early, but also to respond. We are also supporting the distribution of essential medicine, but also trauma kits, particularly for non-communicable diseases and mental health conditions for the displaced population, but also other people that are affected by the conflict. We will be deploying staff to support the Emergency Operations Center, strengthen referral hospital capacity, but also to ensure access to trauma care for war wounded patients. WHO is already propositioning trauma and other supplies and burn supplies, essential medicine, including insulin and other critical supplies on the frontline health facilities. And also we have a designated trauma centers in coordination with the Minister of Health. There are a number of healthcare partners who are supporting the shelters, but also who are supporting some of the referral hospitals to improve the trauma management capacity. I think we are currently undertaking rapid needs assessment in the shelters. Hostel communities are underway with the Ministry of Health as well as other line ministries. And we are working with the partners to keep healthcare as accessible as possible during this difficult time. It's very important to note that, you know, the ongoing airstrikes across, you know, different parts of Lebanon actually has increased the vulnerability of many civilians. And as I reported earlier, that we have increased number of children that have been killed or wounded in this fight. We are trying to scale up actually, you know, the trauma management capacity in frontline hospitals, despite the closure of 5 very important hospitals that was managing the trauma. Another important point that we're trying to scale up also, as my colleague have said earlier, is how we can better provide mental health and psychosocial support for the affected people, for the displaced, the vulnerable, and those people who lost their loved ones. Again, as much as we're trying to scale up the response, the available resources for us, WHO, as well as many other humanitarian agencies here is very limited. And we are appealing to the international community and donors actually to support and to provide resources needed to sustain the response that we continue to deploy. As ever, WHO calls also for the de-escalation and return for peace for everyone, so at least people can live and can enjoy their lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Colleagues, we will be sharing the notes with you. I think some of it was not very understandable because the audio wasn't great, but thank you very much for this very important briefing, Doctor. Okay, we'll turn to you, colleagues, for questions to either Dr. or Ms. Lindholm-Billing or Dr. Abu Bakar from HCR or WHO. So the floor is yours. Starting in the room, if any questions. No, I don't see any questions in the room, online perhaps. Okay, I think therefore, well, we have do have a question, sorry. And yes, of the French news agency, AFP, and yes.
Yes, hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my question. It's a question to WHO on what you mentioned, the potential outbreaks. If you could elaborate on that, tell us what kind of outbreaks do you fear, and if you have already seen any signs of that. Thank you.
Please go ahead, doctor.
Yes, yes, thank you very much. Yes, as the situation evolves, and whenever you have a major displacement and you have a shelters and also you have more vulnerable people staying, I think the risk of potential outbreak is very high. And I think some of our concern is measles among the children, but also we have now we're in the winter season, we might be seeing now we are seeing more upper respiratory tract infection. So potential influenza also is very high situation. But again, we are not, only focusing one or two, but at least we are trying to see how we can monitor the situation and also prevent. I think one of the prevention aspects that we're doing is we are ensuring that every child who comes to the shelters, actually, they get vaccinated for measles as well as other vaccine preventable diseases. But at least the one we're concerned mostly is the vaccine preventable diseases, for example, the measles, the diphtheria, and the polio as well, which, always comes the risk that we may have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Nick, New York Times.
Yeah, thank you for taking the question. Thank you for the briefing. I just wanted to ask why do you think the number of children casualties is higher this time around? And secondly, there have been reports of white phosphorus use by Israeli forces in the operations in Lebanon, and I'm just wondering if you have any casualties associated with that. Thank you.
That's back to you, Doctor.
Thank you very much. I think, one reason why we have a high number of children is, as you know, that the most of the attacks that we see actually is, it's urban centers, like in Beirut, in suburban Beirut, same thing with other locations. And that may be the reason why we have more children as well as more women, actually, that's been impacted as compared to the previous. And remember that this only 7 days conflict, and we are already seeing that almost 100 children that have lost their lives and an increased number of children also that has been wounded. So 20% in total. So this is, our speculation is this is the reason, because most of these attacks are happening in the urban centers and where, some of those buildings that's been attacked. Regarding the white phosphorus, yes, as you recall, in the last conflict, yes, we have documented, the use of white phosphorus as well as some injuries. But at this time, I think we have received the reports, but we have been in touch to the hospitals, and so far we have not received any injuries associated with the white phosphorus as well as other chemicals that's been used previously. But we are investigating and we are monitoring the situation if in case there are people that's been affected. And remember, some of those areas that's been used, that's been reported, that's been used white phosphorus is the area that's been evacuated. So probably, we may not have that many people in that area, but definitely there are many people that have decided not to leave from their homes in those evacuated areas, and they may be at risk for, this white phosphorus contamination. But we will continue to monitor, but also we'll investigate if there is any cases that have been reported. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Further questions? No. Oh, sorry, Nick, is that an old hand or is that a follow-up?
No, it's a quick follow-up. Yep. Doctor, thank you for your explanations. You mentioned 20% of the casualties are children, 20% are women. I wonder if you could just give me specific numbers. Thank you.
Please go ahead, Doctor.
I will be able to give you that number. As soon as we finish, we can send you the details of the figures that we have for the children and the women for specifically, if you don't mind.
Okay, we'll make sure to follow up on that. Thank you very much. We have a question now from Musa of Al Mayadeen TV. Musa. Is this for Musa?
Thank you.
Yeah, if this is for the UNHCR representative or WHO, if you can specify.
UNHCR. Regarding the number of displaced people in Lebanon, is it less or more than in 2024? And did any Lebanese people, refugees in Syria in this time? And how many are they? Thank you.
Thank you, Musa. Over to Catalina.
Yes, I didn't get the second part of the question, but just to say that in 1 week, that almost 700,000 have self-registered on the government platform as displaced. That's a faster pace of displacement compared to in 2024. Can you repeat the second part?
I think it concerned the number going back to Syria, if that's not, if I'm not mistaken, Musa. Maybe you can clarify that. Musa?
Yes, I mean, just the Lebanese people go to Syria, not Syrian people. Thank you.
Okay, back to you, Catalina, about Lebanese going to Syria, if you have any...
Yeah, 7,700 Lebanese have been kind of recorded or mentioned by the Syrian authorities as having entered or arrived to Syria over the past week, 7,700.
Okay, thank you very much for that clarification. And again, we'll certainly share your notes with our colleagues here. Any last questions before we move on to the next briefers? We do have a question from Jamil Shad of a Brazilian journalist, various Brazilian media. Jamil.
Hi there. Thank you, Rolando. A question to WHO. I know that you're going to send the numbers again, but could you repeat the numbers you mentioned to us in a very, I would say, specific way, each one of them? Thank you. So we can, you know, not make any mistakes here. Thank you so much.
Sure. Doctor?
Yes. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. So as of 9th of March, actually, there are 486 deaths related to the conflict. And there are 1,313...
Could I just stop for a second? Can we maybe get you on camera saying that and maybe have your colleague shift the focus on you? Thank you. Let's try that again. It's
2 minutes.
All right, go ahead.
Yes.
I think we're having technical difficulties here, but it's important that we get you on camera to recite these important statistics. If we can't, let's... Okay, if...
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I hope we're connected right now.
Yeah, that's perfect. Just stay like that. Go ahead.
Yeah, just let me repeat. As of 9th of March, we have 586, you know, deaths and fatalities related to the conflict and 1,313 injured related to the conflict. Among the children, we said that there's 84 deaths. And in terms of the women, there are 44, you know, women that have died. Well, but when it comes to the, you know, the number of children that injured, 259. And among the women, there are 280 injuries. Again, let me just connect you the dots. Among the children, we have 84 deaths and 259 injuries. Among the women, we have 44 deaths and 280 deaths. I think it's clear right now for the numbers.
I think if you wouldn't mind repeating that, just to be absolutely extra clear, if you wouldn't mind, Doctor, because it's a little bit muddled.
So the total number of deaths and the fatalities that related to the conflict is 486 deaths and 1,313 injuries related to them. Among children, we have 84 deaths and 259 injuries. Among women, we have 44 deaths and 280 injuries. Among women, 44 deaths and 280 injuries. And among children, we have 84 deaths and 259 injured.
Okay, I thank you very much, doctor. Colleagues, we will share these in writing. These are very important to get the record straight on this. This is a very fluid situation. Let's appreciate that. And thank you very much, doctor, for sharing the updates. And we'll make sure to share your notes, as well as yours, Carolina, who I thank also very much for joining us from Beirut. Sorry, Emma, did you have a question for either briefer? Yeah, go ahead. This is a question for you, Carolina.
One for UNHCR, yeah. I was just hoping you could elaborate a bit more on why there have been so many displaced in one day, 100,000 in one day, and where they've come from. And I had a question for Christian on Iran after, if possible. Thank you.
Okay, Carolina, please.
Yes, I think this very fast pace of displacement is an it's a consequence of several large geographical areas being, you know, called for evacuations by the IDF. So you have the area both south of the Litani River, you have areas north of the Litani River, you have the whole southern suburbs of Beirut, you have parts of the Bekaa Valley, and then you have airstrikes ongoing. So it's quite large and populated geographical areas that are being subject to evacuation orders and airstrikes. And this is leading to this large-scale displacement. Plus, as I mentioned before, many of the people fleeing were also fleeing back in 2024. They were displaced then during that escalation. So they also remember vividly how dangerous the situation was. We met many who then had their homes completely destroyed, family members killed, and so on. So this means that people are not waiting to see what will happen next. They leave immediately.
Thank you very much for that, Carolina. I think that does it for questions to you and to Dr. Aboubakar. So thank you very much for joining us from Beirut. Stay safe, and thank you very much for the important work that you're doing in situ. So a question for Christian on Iran. Go ahead, Emma.
Yes, please. It's on black rain and smoke, please. I understand that the WHO has issued some sort of advisory for Iranians on the dangers of these two phenomena. Could you tell us more about what you sent and also what the dangers are for people's health? Which is worse, the smoke or the rain? And are there any examples already of maybe people being hospitalized or seeking treatment because of complications related to these two phenomena? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Emma. Yeah, the black rain and the acidic rain coming with it is indeed a danger for the population, respiratory mainly, and it could be acidic, depending, of course, what context you have. We are in touch with the hospitals and with the with the authorities, and the Iranian authorities have issued an alert advising people to stay indoors, even in light of the attacks on oil warehouses especially. They have also released public guidance on protection against acidic rainfall following the attacks on oil storage facilities and the massive release of toxic hydrocarbons, sulfur oxides, and nitrogen compounds into the air. So obviously the specific mix would depend on the danger. So we'll continue to monitor the situation closely and support the authorities with public health guidance to help protect the communities and reduce the exposure risk. Additionally, the rainfall mixed with toxic pollutants would be extremely dangerous. That's the advice, with strong acidic properties and could cause chemical burns to the skin and serious damage to the lungs.
So, sorry, it was an Iranian kind of notice to stay indoors, but does the WHO concur? I mean, is that a good idea in these circumstances to stay inside?
To the information what we have, and let's not forget, we do take the information on the substance and the attacks right now from the official sources mainly, which is the Iranian authorities. So given what is at risk right now, the oil storage facilities, the refineries that have been struck, triggering fires and raising serious air quality concerns. That is definitely a good idea. It always depends on the exact location where you are, obviously, on the wind direction and all these factors. But the overall advice is absolutely valid.
Nina, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Hi, Christian. Just to follow up on that, I was wondering sort of what your main concerns would be in the longer term. I mean, I would expect, you know, water sources and contamination of that kind. Could you say sort of what kind of health risk people might be exposed to beyond the immediate sort of chemical burns, possibly? Thank you.
I mean, the additional reported strikes on oil infrastructures also in Bahrain and in Saudi Arabia certainly raise concerns of wider regional pollution exposure. And the toxic pollutions and pollutants that affect respiratory health and contaminate air and water can have long-term effects. We don't have too much yet on exactly the proportions of it, but it is a dangerous situation. It needs to be closely monitored and watched, and ideally there is enough space to control fires, to control the space and be able to contain any pollutants in the air or in the water, but that needs resources on the ground that can operate freely. So for now, we can only support the authorities on the ground with public health messaging and with research and monitor as good as we can in the given situation.
Thank you very much, Christian. I see that Ravina, I'm not sure if Ravina's connected, but I think she has something. There you are, Ravina. I think you wanted to add something from your perspective, from human rights perspective. Go ahead.
Thanks, Rolando. Indeed, on these attacks in particular, we are concerned about the impact of these attacks on civilians' right to health, as well as on the environment. We're also concerned that the foreseeable impact on civilians and the environment of these strikes raises serious questions as to whether the proportionality and precaution obligations under international humanitarian law were met in these attacks. These attacked sites do not appear to be of military exclusive usage.
Thank you very much to compliment that. We have a question from John Zarakostas.
Yes, good morning, Christian. I was wondering if you could check and come back to us if the heavy inhalation of toxic hydrocarbons, is there a risk of potential renal failure in people? Thank you.
As you said, John, I would need to check that.
That's very specific question, but I'm sure Christian will get back to you on that. Thank you, John. Further questions before we move to our next subject? Okay, I think that does it. Thank you very much, Christian. Feel free to stay here with me if you like. We're going to move to, it's in the broader region, but now we're going to move to the Afghanistan-Iranian border, where two colleagues, we're very grateful to have two colleagues joining us from the border near Isal Qata. This is inside Afghanistan, along the border with Iran. We have Arafat Jamal, who is UNHCR's representative in Kabul, is joining us, as well as Tajuddin Oyewale, who's a representative for Afghanistan for UNICEF. So maybe Arafat will start with you first. Thank you very much again.
Thank you very much, Rolando, and greetings to everybody. As mentioned, I'm here with my colleague Tajuddin from UNICEF. We're both at the border between Afghanistan and Iran in a place called Islam Qala. And we've just heard from 4,000 kilometers away in Lebanon the effects of this conflict. And you can see that the ramifications are truly, the geographical scope is incredible. And we are here at the border to assess the implications for Afghanistan and for the Afghans who are inside Iran. There are no good choices for the Afghans in Iran today. they are at, they find themselves in the middle of a war, as with all the other Iranian citizens as well. And their choice is to stay and to bear the consequences, as everybody inside that country, or to flee to Afghanistan, which itself is embroiled in a war. And let us not forget that Afghanistan has been experiencing an open war with Pakistan since earlier this year. In addition, any Afghan who chooses or is forced to return is facing not only the conflict, but they're facing a very very dismal economic situation, a shrinking humanitarian and protection space, and very few prospects for them. This morning, I spoke to a number of Afghans at the border who were coming across from Iran. These people seem to have been moving in a preemptive manner. Most of them that I spoke to described scenes of bombardment wherever they were, and a feeling that they needed to leave. They needed to leave for their own security, or they needed to leave because prospects for everyone in Iran were dwindling, including economic prospects, and there was simply no reason for them to stay in Iran. So I would describe the current movement as a preemptive move. The number of returns thus far in this year has been 110,000 Afghans returning. So around 1,700 are coming back daily since the onset of the conflict in the Middle East. The situation, although the situation today, I would describe it as being deceptively calm, with the returns happening in an orderly fashion. At the same time, they're freighted with tension and apprehension. People who we've spoken to have been directly affected by the bombings, and they are now finding themselves facing cycles of displacement. First, forced to flee Afghanistan, later displaced again inside Iran due to the conflict, and now returning once more to Afghanistan. And upon return in Afghanistan, these triply displaced people enter into a spiral of precarity and uncertainty. Although the numbers are not yet large, I do fear that there is more to come. There is more to come from Iran, and there is more to come from Pakistan. We will be faced with displacement and returns from two frontiers very soon. I'm here, as mentioned, with UNICEF and also with other United Nations colleagues. We are equipped to deal with the returns. Based on our experience last year, where Afghanistan received the largest number globally of returns, some almost 3 million Afghans returned back, we know how to deal with it. We have the infrastructure, we have the people, but what we are sorely lacking is sustained and generous financial support. If we do not receive this, we will find this vast region that, as we saw, stretches all the way from Lebanon to Afghanistan, we may experience yet another destabilized country over here. So all I can say on that is that this Afghanistan is facing the ramifications of what is happening with Iran. It is layering itself on top of an existing war on another frontier, and we are preparing for massive returns. We are prepared, but we are not funded. And I will now hand over to my colleague and friend, Dr. Tajuddin of UNICEF.
Thank you.
Thank you very
much. Thank you, Arif.
And just to mention that we also have James online from UNICEF, but over to you, Tajuddin. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much. And let me echo what Arafat said, that the ongoing escalating crisis in the Middle East is already having implications for children beyond borders. At Islam Qala border in Afghanistan, we are seeing an increase in individual and family returns in the last few weeks. Like Arafat said, the numbers may not be alarming as of today, but clearly what we are seeing is concerning. For example, this morning, When I went to meet with our nutritionist on the ground, she shared with me that the total number of children who have been screened and treated for malnutrition has doubled in the last 1 week. Also, when I spoke to some of the individual returnees that I met with this morning, they clearly informed me that many more are on the way, because those we are seeing now were able to brave the difficult journey, the cold, windy weather, and the risk along the way to get into the border. As such, as a country team, we are preparing for a higher number of return in the course of the weeks to come. Specifically for children, I'm very concerned on what this crisis means for our children. If you recall the last year when we had the high peak of the response, we had a huge number of children who were separated or unaccompanied across the two borders. For UNICEF, we were able to provide family reunification and family tracing services for more than 6,000 children last year alone. And when we have a huge number this year, I can imagine what that would look like. I recall the last time I was here in Islamkala when I met with some of the children returning from Iran, and they described to me how difficult the journey to the border was and how unclear their fate for the future looks like. I can only but reflect further now what that will mean today when families start to come in huge number from Iran across the border, and what the level of trauma that the children coming with them will have seen. Arafat said we had about 3 million Afghans return to the country last year, both from Pakistan and Afghanistan. Let me add that amongst that, 60% of that were families with children. And when you have families with children, the whole situation becomes more complicated. And that is what we do as a country team to respond to the situation. Yes, we have the capability and the know-how. Yes, we have the partnership to respond, but we do need support and consistent, flexible funding to be able to take forward the response that is required on the ground. For us as UNICEF and partners, we are very concerned that as we take forward this response, our preparedness action around nutrition counseling, immunization, primary health care, access to water, sanitation and hygiene, and child protection services that is on ground will be able to respond if we're able to provide adequate resources as we speak. You may want to know that the humanitarian response plan in Afghanistan is currently only funded at 10%. So we're starting the year with a major funding shortfall, and we are looking towards a huge returnee crisis that is beyond what we can handle. The response to the returnee crisis starts in the border, but it also goes beyond the border to communities. So our action needs to go not only at the border, but also what we do at the communities. And for families who come into Islamkala, when they move into communities, they will add on to the total number of people who are accessing social services that is already strained on the ground. So we need to respond both at the border point, but also at the communities in a context where things are extremely difficult in Afghanistan. To add to the situation, two more dimensions that is important to share from our perspective. The geopolitical tension is already disrupting procurement routes. What this means is that supplies that we need to care for children and their mothers in the midst of this emergency will arrive late. A clear example is that a malnourished child will only get the nutrition supplement required, not immediately, but with some level of delay and at a higher cost. And this is part of the implication of this geopolitical tension. On the ground for us in Afghanistan, the recent escalation in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border crisis is also adding to the existing humanitarian situation. We have already documented around 164,000 people who are internally displaced due to this crisis, amongst whom are 30,000 survivors of the earthquake that we had last year. This means that displacement for us in this country this year is going to be more complicated than we have ever had when we start having population movement, both from the West and the East, but also coupled with internal displacement. So we are asking for early action to support the work we have to do while we track the movement across all the borders into the country. And those early action will include additional support from partners to help us with airlifting of supplies so that we can address the major concerns around procurement of humanitarian supplies, but also direct funding to the humanitarian response plan and to the UNICEF appeal for children in the country. Our message is very, very clear. Children must be protected and be supported at every stage of the response to the ongoing crisis. Because for children, their lives is not just tomorrow, it starts from today. And we count on your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tajuddin and Arafat Jan, as well, for that important briefing. Colleagues, again, where they're briefing from is inside the Afghan border, along close to the Iranian border, Isalqata, I-S-A-L-Q-A-T-A, if I'm not mistaken. Let me just point one additional comment. We had our Deputy Secretary, the Special Representative, the Secretary General Georgette Gagnon, who is the acting head of mission for the UN mission in Kabul, who briefed the Security Council yesterday, echoing many of the points from our colleagues, which we just heard, including the 10% appeal. Only 10% of the appeal has been funded. She spoke of the broader disruptions, a worsening country's fragile economy. She also referred to the situation of women and girls, concerns about terrorism and other major obstacles. So I would suggest you read Ms. Gagnon's statement to the Security Council, which she delivered after hours, Geneva time, yesterday. So let's turn to you for questions. We have a few in the room. Let's start off with Nina, AFP.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the briefing. For UNHCR, I had a few questions. You mentioned that you're appealing for funds, but I didn't hear you say how much it is that you need for the situation. And then I was hoping you could clarify a little bit on the numbers, because I think you were talking about the numbers who had fled per day since the conflict started. I was wondering if that was just from Iran or if it was also from Pakistan. If you could give us both of those numbers, that would be helpful. And how that compared to the start of the year. Those main things. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Maybe Arafat Jan, maybe that's for you, starting off, maybe.
Sure. Thank you very much for the two questions. Regarding the amount that we need, we're actually in the process of preparing our appeal, so I'd rather hold on that when we get an exact figure. On the second question, in terms of numbers, so this year alone, accounting from January 1st, we've had 110,000 returns of Afghans from Iran, 160,000 Afghan returns from Pakistan. And in addition, as Tajuddin was talking about, we've had internal displacement of to the tune of about 115,000, and that's all along the frontier with Pakistan.
Okay, I think that's...
Sorry, yeah. And on the funding, you were talking about a lack of funding. So even if you're not giving the actual amount, could you say how much you've received or how much could you compare it to what you've been asking for previously? You know, how big of a shortfall is there right now? Thanks.
Yeah, it's massive, as you heard Georgette Gagnon being quoted. For UNHCR, our current budget has been around $200 million. For the year, and we are at this point 15% funded. But as I said, those figures will be changing.
Yeah, Babar is also here in case he can complement any specific questions you have on the funding issue. So thank you very much. Emma, Reuters.
Yes, for UNICEF, please. I was hoping you could elaborate a bit more on the supply chain issues. Were you saying that this is something that's going to happen, that nutrition supplements for children are going to start arriving late because of Iran, or is this already happening? And could you explain a bit the logistics? Where are they coming from and to Afghanistan? And have you had to reroute at all? Thank you.
No, thank you so much. And it's a very valid question. We are already experiencing some of these supply chain disruptions. Most, for example, for nutrition supplies, we do some procurement from Europe and India, and our normal entry route for supplies to Afghanistan is often through Pakistan. And now with the ongoing clash between the two countries and the border closures, that option is not viable. So we are now exploring new routes through the Northern Corridor through Europe to then get into Uzbekistan and then drive down those supplies from Termiz. So that is extra additional time. But in addition to that, with what is going on now with the disruption in the airline industry because of the crisis in the Middle East, we are having more challenges in doing that. We have been fortunate lately with donors like ECHO and FCDO supporting us to do airlifting of some nutrition supplies directly from Europe to Afghanistan to cushion the immediate gap that we have. But that will not sustain the kind of response and the prevailing needs that we have in the country. So yes, we are already being impacted by the disruption around the logistics in the country.
Thanks very much for that. Nina, you think you had a quick follow-up?
Yeah, sorry. Sorry to be harping on numbers, but I wanted to just make sure I understood on the for UNHCR again, on the number of people who have left, you said, I think it was 170, 1,700 per day since the conflict started. Is that only from Iran or is that also from Pakistan? And also, it would be good to know how many Afghans are considered to be within Iran to have an idea of this of the scale. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. Important questions. So the figure of 1,700 per day is exclusive to Iran. And in terms of the estimate of Afghans inside Iran, I will turn to Babar, who may have the best on that.
Sure. Thank you, Arfajan. So the number of registered Afghan refugees and others who are still inside Iran, that number is 1.65 million that are still there. Remember, as mentioned by colleagues, last year we saw nearly 3 million Afghans returning from Iran and Pakistan. A majority of those were from Iran. Thank you. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Baba. We have a question online. Gabriela Proceso of Mexico. Gabby.
Yes, thank you. I don't have a question on this subject, but I saw that Francois Richer is there, and I would like to know what is happening with my accreditation.
Gabby, let's talk about this after the briefing. This is a housekeeping matter, so we really need to stick with the briefers, if that's okay. Okay, Gabriela? Thank you.
Yeah, okay, but if he can check his...
We will, gracias, thank you very much. We'll move on, thank you, we'll get back to you on that. Okay, I think that does it for questions to our briefers from, and I correct myself, it's Alcala, Q-A-L-L-A, pardon me, again, in Afghanistan along the Iranian border. Thank you both very much, Arafat Jan and Tajuddin, for this important briefing. We'll definitely connect with you and make sure we'll share your notes with our colleagues here to amplify these important messages. So thanks once again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move to our friend Jean-Martin Bauer of the World Food Program, joining us from Rome. He is, as you know, director of WFP's Food and Nutrition Analysis Service. He's going to speak about, sticking on the subject at hand, the Middle East crisis. He's going to talk about the escalating conflict and implications on global food security. So, Jean-Martin, over to you.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to brief you on this matter. I'd like to start by conveying my concern about the severe disruptions that global supply chains are experiencing as a result of the Middle East crisis. This is nothing less than another seminal moment in global supply chain history with impacts on the economy and on food security and on humanitarian response. I'd like to break that down. Right now, what we're seeing is an impact, of course, in the Strait of Hormuz, but also in the Bab el-Mandeb. So two key points of the global supply chain setup are affected by restrictions and by risk, and shipping lines are diverting their services. The scheduling of these services has become less reliable. There are surcharges, emergency surcharges being charged to their customers. This is leading to quite some impact. We're seeing congestion in places that are very far from Hormuz. We're seeing congestion in Asia. It's quite a severe disruption that's taking place right now. We're seeing disruption in the Indian Ocean. Ports, logistics hubs, and inland supply chains are all affected. And this is obviously having an impact on trade, also on humanitarian supply chains. And to follow up and provide a little bit more detail, you heard my colleagues from Afghanistan mention how complicated it is for them to bring in fresh supplies into Afghanistan. This is something we're seeing for very many countries in that part of the world. Now, for example, we're seeing war risk insurance that's increase and at a cost of between $2,000 and $4,000 for each container in areas that are at risk. We're also seeing that we're needing to go the long way around the Cape of Good Hope to reach some of our key geographies. Right now, the biggest operation for the World Food Program is in Sudan. Sudan is supplied through the port of Port Sudan. What we usually do with the contributions we receive is purchase food in India, take that food to Salalah. From Salalah, it goes by ship to Jeddah, and from Jeddah into Port Sudan. Right now, with the situation at hand, shipping lines are taking the same shipment from Mumbai to Salalah to Tangiers to Port Said, and Said to Jeddah, and then to Port Sudan. That's an additional sail of 9,000 kilometers, quite the distance. It's like going coast to coast in the U.S. and then going back, and that's adding approximately 25 days to shipping times. So that gives you an idea of how disrupted supply chains can be, and we're talking about a part of the world with very high vulnerability. I mentioned Sudan. This is where you also have Yemen, a place with people living in famine-like conditions in parts of Yemen. There's a drought in Somalia, a place where the number of acutely food insecure people has increased from 4.5 million to 6 million. So these costs and the lost time are having quite an impact on humanitarian programs if the situation lasts longer. So yesterday we had oil trading above $100 for the first time in a while, and this really brings to mind analogs in the past. So we had the situation in 2007 and 2008 with a very high cost of energy, very high cost of food, a global inflationary episode with which also led to violence in the streets. There was a few years later in 2011, the same thing with energy and food prices rising, with also impacts on stability and on food security. The supply chain impacts were also quite severe at the start of the COVID pandemic and also at the start of the conflict in Ukraine. And what's going on today is reminding us of those episodes. They could definitely, if the situation lasts longer, turn into an impact on global inflation because of impacts on the fertilizer market. Many of the precursors do come from the Gulf. That flow has stopped, and fertilizer prices are increasing at a time where we've got the 2026 crop that's being put in the ground. So let's be careful. Let's be monitoring this very closely because of the potential impact this could have on global markets, on food security, and on very many vulnerable countries. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Jean-Martin. Let's take a question from Kazmira of Geneva Solutions.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. On the cost of the war risk insurance, do you have the comparative figure? So what it would typically cost, you gave the figure for now. And then and also you mentioned the number of days is 25 days that is adding to these routes. Again, do you have any figures for the cost as well of those extra added days to shipping routes? Thank you.
Back to you.
So thanks, Thanks, Jose Mario. So what I'd say on that, the it's still early days, and I don't have the overall cost to provide you. But the nearest situation we've had in the past was when the Red Sea crisis occurred in 2023 and 2024. Then at that time, the cost to WFP was an additional cost of 15 to 40% on our shipping in that part of the world. And if we look at the time it takes, the additional time we have, and I said it's 25 days more, well, it's basically 50% more than we would usually have. So that's really extending the supply chain and adding to cost. I mentioned the cost of war risk insurance of $2,000 to $4,000 per container. That's an additional cost that we're looking at right now.
And sorry, just a quick follow-up. Are any insurers refusing insurance, or it hasn't got to that point yet?
I'll have to get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you very much to you, Casimira, for the question. And Jean-Martin, I think that's it. John Zarakostas has a question for you from The Lancet and France 24.
Good morning, Jean-Martin. I was wondering, you briefed us in January on the potential food insecurity in West African countries. Do you have an update? I think at the time you mentioned 55 million people were at risk, including 13 million children. Do you have an update on how all this sudden crisis could also impact on the situation in Western Central Africa? Thank you.
So the situation in Western Central Africa was provided at the by the SILS. The numbers were provided by the SILS, which is the interstate mechanism in West Africa, in December. They will provide an update very soon. So if you ask me the question in April, I'll be able to give you an updated set of numbers. But of course, West Africa happens to be a part of the world that where some highly vulnerable countries depend largely on imports for their fuel supply and for their fertilizer. We need to be watching West Africa very closely because of its the potential impacts there. What we learned in 2022, when the global fertilizer market was affected by the conflict in Ukraine, was that farmers in places like West Africa and Central Africa and East and Southern Africa were the most affected by the increased price of fertilizer. We saw that there's a vulnerability that's there and that we need to look out for.
Okay, well noted. Thank you very much. And of course, do come back next month to brief us on these other issues. Emma, yeah, go ahead, Reuters.
Hi again, Jean-Martin. I just wanted to get an idea of how long your buffers will last. Presumably, you have some pre-positioned supplies, but eventually, if these delays continue, you won't be able to replenish them. Can you tell us how long your pre-positioned supplies might last for example, for a place like Sudan? Thank you.
So Emma, thanks for asking a very relevant question. I don't have the exact number of days to tell you right now, but what I can say is that overall WFP programs are under-resourced. We've experienced substantial funding cuts in the past year, and that's meant that there's simply less food in the countries that we work in to provide and supply these programs and support the vulnerable population. So this situation of Hormuz and Bab el-Mandeb being at risk, and the global supply chains being in a situation of severe disruption. This is happening at a time when we have very limited stocks in country, where humanitarian programs have shrunk. This is a factor that's aggravating existing vulnerabilities and risk at the field level for us.
Thank you very much. I think that does it for questions for you, Jean-Martin. Thank you again for joining us, as always. Colleagues, on a very important and related note, I wanted to flag that there's a report from the UN Trade and Development that will be out momentarily, which speaks to the implications for global trade and development concerning the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, disruptions. So this is the report which you'll have shortly. It has lots of figures, many of those which I'm sure you'd be interested in. So do take a look at that report, which again will be in your inboxes rather soon. And if you have any questions, of course, do contact colleagues at UN Trade and Development. Okay, moving on. We have one last topic and a couple of announcements left. So now I turn to our colleague Devanand Ramia, who is from UNDP, UNDP's Director of Crisis Readiness, Response and Recovery, who's speaking to a new partnership with UNITAR and UNDP to leverage satellite imagery to guide faster recovery in crisis zones. So Devanand, over to you, and thank you for joining.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to brief today. As you know, satellite imagery is often associated with war, but satellite imagery can also guide faster response and recovery in crisis zones. So today, the United Nations Development Program and the United Nations Satellite Center, which is hosted by the United Nations Institute for Training and Research, are strengthening our partnership to deliver rapid crisis impact analysis. This new partnership reduces assessment times from weeks to just 48 hours. The first 48 hours after a disaster is critical. They shape the decisions that determine how quickly communities can recover. Government, partners, and communities need immediate answers to questions such as which communities are hit hardest, which hospital roads and infrastructure are damaged, and where displacement may occur. Without this information, recovery planning can be delayed. This is where this partnership comes in. It combines satellite analysis with field verification to produce integrated crisis assessments. Geospatial analysis allows us to see thousands of square kilometers at once, even where physical access is impossible, providing an early picture of damages and risks. The process involves three simple steps. First, satellite imagery is analyzed immediately after a crisis using advanced digital tools and AI tools. Second, UNDP teams validate these findings on the ground or provide additional information from the ground that strengthens the digital and analytics. And third, governments and partners receive this verified data to guide their planning. The result is assessments delivered up to 30% faster, providing clear evidence to guide recovery operations and resource allocations. We have already seen how this approach makes a difference. Following the 2025 earthquake in Myanmar, satellite analysis and field verification identified 2.5 million tons of debris, more than 10,000 damaged buildings, health facilities exposed to the earthquake. This information helped UN and partners to guide debris removal, prioritize buildings for structural integrity assessments and infrastructure repair. After Hurricane Melissa in Jamaica in 2025, satellite analysis and field verification showed 4.8 million tons of debris, roads, schools, and hospitals blocked or inaccessible. Authorities used this data to plan large-scale clearance operations and restore access to essential services. Similarly, also in Sri Lanka, satellite data after Cyclone Ditwa revealed that over half of the people in flooded areas were already highly vulnerable, which enabled government and UN partners effort on livelihood restoration and support to businesses, mainly MSMEs. So in closing, each year, more than 300 million people are affected by crisis, while humanitarian resources are increasingly stretched. So better data allows the UN and partners to target assistance to the most affected areas, strengthen coordination across response and partners, and support evidence-based appeals and recovery planning. Simply put, faster data means faster response and recovery. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Devanand. I appreciate that. Questions? No, I don't see that's the case. I think you were very, very clear, so thanks very much. This new partnership sounds very promising, so thank you very much for joining us here in Geneva. Colleagues, just a couple of announcements. Karima and Giovanna are with us here, so over to Karima for an announcement, and then Giovanna.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here to announce an important step in the global effort to address rising inequality. Many of you might know that the latest G20, governments, UN leaders, and leading experts are coming together to establish the International Panel on Inequality, inspired by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The idea was recommended in a G20 report led by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, highlighting the need for a global scientific and policy platform dedicated to understanding inequality. So on March 16, so next Monday, UNRIS, the UN Research Institute for Social Development, will co-convene with Executive Director Winnie Banyama. The first meeting on the founding committee of the International Panel on Inequality here in Geneva de Palais. It will also have the presence, of course, of Professor Stiglitz and founding government, including South Africa, Spain, Brazil, and Norway, who supported the initiative, part of the committee, and also were supported by Africa Union and European Council. The committee warns that the world may be approaching a critical turning point. Extreme inequality is increasingly undermining both democracy and economic progress. Since 2020, shocks such as COVID-19, but also the escalating conflicts that we see now and global trade tensions have created what experts have described as perfect storm. Today, 1 in 4 people worldwide regularly skip meals, while billionaire wealth has reached record levels. So to help address this challenge, the International Panel on Inequality will provide an independent, science-based platform to monitor inequality trends, analyzing the drivers, and assess policy solutions for governments and international community. So we'll, if you're interested to come, we'll also send a press communique and also assist you for interviews. And the event will take place in room 8 from 3:30 to 5 o'clock Monday, 16th of March. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sounds very interesting. So yeah, that press communique would be helpful. So thanks very much for sharing this information for this meeting on Monday. So thanks, Karima. Questions? No, I think it was. Oh, yes, John.
Yeah, I was wondering. You mentioned Professor Joe Stiglitz. Is he coming in person or is it via video link? Thank you.
Sorry. Yes, he will be coming in person along with all the members, all their leading economists.
Okay. Thank you very much, Giovanna.
Thank you, and good day to everyone. Just to mention that the main UN body for vehicle regulations, and that's UNICE's World Forum for Harmonization of Vehicle Regulations, is meeting this week, so 10th to 13th of March, at the Palais des Nations, in room 12. The forum will deliberate on several new UN vehicle regulations, including on limiting brake particle emissions, lifetime monitoring of vehicle pollution, as well as the driver fatigue. Once adopted, the press will be notified about the details of these regulations. Also, just as a reminder, hosted by UNICE, the World Forum is a unique global platform responsible for the regulatory frameworks regarding the safety and environmental performance of vehicles. The World Forum manages 3 global vehicle regulations, and any country that is a member of the UN can participate in these activities in the forum and accede to these agreements. Thank you.
Thank you. Another very immensely important subject. Thank you very much, Giovanna. Questions? No, I think that was very clear. So thank you both very much for the announcements. I have a few announcements of my own. Yes, you can stay here and keep me company if you like. Just a few announcements. I know it's been a long briefing. Just wanted to make sure you have your fingers on the pulse. SG message, rather the statement of the Secretary General to the Commission on the Status of Women, we shared with you last night, a very important meeting taking place on the other side of the pond in New York at headquarters. Among other things, the Secretary General notes how gender equality is and has always been a question of power. Not a single step forward for women's rights has ever been given. It has been won, he says. Important statement that we shared with you. We have a short readout we shared with you earlier this morning of a meeting the Secretary General had with the President of the Philippines. That's in your inbox. We also have a statement from the Secretary General on the congratulating the Colombian people for their peaceful participation on the 8 March elections for a new Congress and the inter-party primaries ahead of the presidential elections in Colombia in May. So that's a statement we shared with you as well. lots of meetings, lots and lots of meetings taking place here in Geneva. We have rarely three concurrent treaty body meetings taking place. We have the Human Rights Committee, we have the Committee on Enforced Disappearances, which began its 30th session yesterday, as well as the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So you've seen the media advisories, you see the, I'm not going to recite all the countries. Just a note that the Committee on Enforced Disappearances is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. It's an important, to mark the important work the convention and the committee has done over these last 20 years. We'll be doing lots to promote that. So those meetings are taking place here in Geneva. We also have a meeting, sorry, from the Conference on Disarmament this morning. I think by now it's probably done. It started at 10 a.m. It's taking place in room 7. If you're interested in the Conference on Disarmament, we could liaise or rather point you to our colleagues there. The Human Rights Council, as you well know, continues its important 61st session. Lots of rapporteurs, mostly dedicated to the situation of children, children's rights. We had the special rapporteur on the sale, sexual exploitation and sexual abuse of children. We have the special representative of the Secretary General on violence against children, as well as the special representative for children and armed conflict. And this afternoon, we'll have Ben Saul, the rapporteur on counterterrorism. So lots happening there. Maybe just to mention that in New York, the Security Council is meeting on the situation in the Middle East. Since we talked about that extensively today, I wanted to make sure you're aware of that. Going back to the rapporteur, or actually the special representative of the Secretary General on Violence Against Children, she is presenting her report to the council, which is dealing with the issue of cyberbullying. The title is Cyberbullying is Not a Future Concern, It's a Current Epidemic, immensely important subject being addressed by the special representative, in her report to the council. And I missed saying it earlier, our colleagues from IOM are still here, yes, Omondi is here. Just to mention that IOM is available. We have representatives from Lebanon, I believe, your IOM representative in Lebanon, who we heard from recently. He's available for interviews as well from Beirut, and other colleagues in Cairo are also available to speak to you should you need some comments from the International Organization for Migration. Lastly, we have how many press conferences? One, two, three, five press conferences to announce. One taking place this afternoon from this podium at 2 p.m. This is with the group of experts on Nicaragua. The three experts will be here to brief you. This is a group set up by the Human Rights Council some years ago. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. now, it was for 3 p.m., now 2 p.m., Mr. Tom Fletcher, who you know well, the Emergency Relief Coordinator, will be here to brief you on the Global Humanitarian Overview Hyper-Prioritized Plan for 2026. So Tom Fletcher here tomorrow at 2 p.m. Thursday at 1 p.m., the Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine will be briefing you. Again, 1 p.m. Thursday with Ukraine commissioners. The three commissioners will brief you from here. And then also on Thursday at 2:30, the Rapporteur on Counterterrorism, Ben Saul, who I just referred to, will be doing a presser with you here. So again, 2:30 on Thursday. And last but not least, the Special Rapporteur on Myanmar, Tom Andrews, who you know well, will be briefing you ahead of this press briefing on Friday at 9:30 a.m., Rapporteur Tom Andrews for Myanmar. Very important encounter indeed. So that is it for me. John?
Rolando, can you bring us up to speed if there are other senior UN officials from New York in Geneva for meetings besides Mr. Fletcher?
Sure. Yeah, well, as you know, lots of senior representatives pass through here for various meetings, either for the Human Rights Council.
I'm interested in the ones that where they're making speeches in public forums.
I'll have to check. There are some executive briefings which are scheduled in the coming days. These are opportunities for the senior UN leadership to brief member states, and whenever they do pass through, we always ask if they have the opportunity to speak with you. So I'll definitely check in with our colleagues who are managing these executive briefings. I mentioned Tom Fletcher, of course, who comes here quite often, but I'll look into some other senior representatives from the UN who might be here, and I'll get back to you. Further questions? No? Well, we just made it under an hour and a half, so thank you very much for your attention and for your reporting, and see you here on Friday.